Hello and welcome to the Charity Times Leadership Podcast, where we speak to leaders from across the sector about trends, challenges and success stories. My name is Lauren Weymouth. I'm the editor of Charity Times, and I'll be bringing you a series of charity leadership podcasts designed to inspire you as you navigate your way through the year ahead. Many of you will be aware that the food system is currently under extreme pressure. The food system is responsible for around 25% of global greenhouse emissions, and it's a major driver of climate change. Food production depletes freshwater resources, pollutes ecosystems, and the planet can only take so much of this stress. The problem is also twofold, in that as the human population increases, producing enough food globally is going to be a huge challenge. In fact, research from the World Wildlife Fund has suggested that there's going to be the need to produce more food in the next four decades than we have in the entire 8,000 years of human history. As a result, food prices are rising to almost unsustainable levels, and there is a desperate need for the food system to become much more sustainable, something that all investors will need to take into consideration. Charities are by no means exempt, and all investment portfolios will need to be carefully monitored and adapted to ensure systemic change happens, and that it happens quickly. With this in mind, I'm joined today by Genevieve Shah, Portfolio Manager at Saracen & Partners. Genevieve is co-portfolio manager for the firm's food and agriculture opportunities. He's also an equity analyst covering global food and agriculture. Genevieve joined Saracen & Partners in 2017, and prior to this, he worked at T. Rowe Price as an international equity analyst for 7 years. Genevieve began his investment career in 2008 at Mirae Asset Global Investment as an emerging market analyst. Today, we're going to be discussing some of the pressures on the food system and looking at how this is likely to affect charity investment portfolios. So welcome, Genevieve. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you, Lauren. Great to be on the podcast.
It's really good to talk to you about this. And actually, I must admit, when I was doing research prior to this podcast, I was slightly alarmed by some of the statistics. I guess it's fairly worrying for us as a society, let alone for investors. But it's certainly a conversation that desperately needs to be had.
That's right. I agree.
So let's start by providing a little bit of background for our listeners. So just how resilient is the current food system?
So I firstly would want to just maybe explain how I and others out there think about resilience. I think you have to look at this from a very holistic stance. So you've got to think about social, economic, environmental, a range of different factors by which you can decide whether a system, in this case, the food system is resilient. It's also the ability to for the system to recover from a disruption or a series of crises or mini crises. And my opinion is that the food system as it is today is not particularly resilient. There are a lot of challenges, including constraints on land, fresh water. We're seeing climate and geopolitics also have challenges on the food system. We're also incredibly dependent on certain countries being large food producers and others being importers and very dependent on those countries. And then lastly, the system has dramatically changed in the last 30, 40 years as we've moved more and more towards a monoculture approach to producing and growing our grains and livestock. So unfortunately, the resilience is something that needs to be improved.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I guess the most simple way of putting this for the average person is, you know, people will have noticed in supermarkets, the prices of food have gone up as everything has, I guess, recently. What is actually causing such high food prices? And do you think this trend is likely to continue?
Yeah, food price inflation has been unprecedented in the last 12 months. We were used to, as a society, a period of very benign food inflation, and that happened over many decades. There's been waves of investments into the use of, unfortunately, chemicals designed to improve yield and reduce pests on the farm. We've also got used to a bit more technology and automation, albeit there's still room for more of that to happen on the farm and in processing of food. What's caused the high food prices? It's been three or four things. One has been the climate effect, increased droughts, heat stress, floods even in some parts of the world, destroying crops and produce. But we've also had supply chain disruption as a result of COVID. So that's meant it's been harder to get food from those countries that produce it to those that import it. And then geopolitics, which really kicked in at the beginning of this year in February with Russia's invasion into Ukraine and the resultant hit. To give you an idea, Ukraine is about 15% of global corn exports, 10% of global wheat exports. So it's a big producer of quite important grains that are not just used by humans directly for consumption, but are used to feed animal livestock. Poultry and pigs and cattle, et cetera. And unfortunately, we're still a society that is predominantly eating traditional animal protein. We haven't made that transition yet. So these are the real reasons. The trend, I think it will continue for certainly into next year for some time, albeit the sort of year-on-year increases will start to ease off a little bit, but we are not going to retrace those prices until we see a bit more resilience in the system.
Mm. And what are the environmental challenges in terms of how we produce agricultural crops and grains? Sort of thinking about the future and what we need to do in terms of making a big difference. What does that kind of look like? What are those main challenges?
Yeah, great question, Lauren. So absolutely, we want to make the food system more resilient, but also a bit more responsible and less unsustainable, then we do need to make that transition away from using chemicals on our food. And there's a couple of reasons for that. One is, humans don't want to have chemical residue on their food items. It's potentially dangerous to human bodies. It's not as healthy for us. But it also has terrible effects on fresh water, on rivers, as some of those chemicals go into those waterways. It causes soil to obviously degrade, as does the use of heavy equipment, so tilling the land. All of these practices need to be somewhat unwound, and we need to move away from using chemicals and moving more to using naturals or biologicals in order to keep pests away from produce, vegetables, grains, etc. We also need to regenerate the soil, and regenerative agriculture is gaining in popularity. And these are ways that we can ensure that we have soil for decades ahead that doesn't lose its ability to provide nutrients for growing crops. And then lastly, biodiversity. So, unfortunately, we are constrained on the amount of land, and over many decades, farmers have removed hedgerows. That's been bad for making sure that animals have their natural habitats, but in particular, insects such as bees, which are pollinators for the food system, incredibly important. Many of your listeners will, I'm sure, be aware of that. So there are ways that we can do this through the use of technology. So using more precision equipment to reduce the amount of application of chemicals. There are biotech companies that can come up with biological substitutes for crop chemicals. And then there are subsidies and incentives that can be put in place to make sure farmers adopt these practices and put hedgerows back in.
It's interesting because there's clearly a lot that we need to change to move towards a more sustainable food system. But what are the social implications? Because presumably there are a lot of communities around the world that rely on the production of food in the way that we've been doing it for years. So what are the social issues there?
Yeah, so I'll give you a couple of interesting statistics. So the sort of agriculture industry is actually one of the largest employers in the world. When you look at it as a percentage of GDP, it's only sort of 5% of global GDP comes from activities involved in producing food on farms. But it's a very fragmented industry. So there's a lot of subsistence farmers, especially in developing countries where farmers are reliant on producing food for their livelihood. And so when you look at agriculture as a percentage of employment, it's actually 14% of global employment. So you can see the difference. It's smaller in economic terms, but bigger in employment terms. And therefore, it is imperative that we think about how people are employed in the food system. That's not just on the farm and ensuring that in those developing countries, we don't have children of those farmers manually working and not going to school, but also within the processing facilities and the distribution and transportation that we don't have poor labor practices. So it's something that we do keep a close eye on the companies that we invest in here at Saracen.
So, you know, we spoke briefly prior to this discussion about this topic, and you know, you said that the way that we're heading, we're looking at a future whereby there essentially will not be enough food for everybody. What does the future look like in terms of food consumption?
I think we're certainly more likely to see a more tighter supply of food. I think prices will have just adjust, so we won't necessarily run out of food, but people will have to pay a little bit more. I think the future of food consumption is one where most people want nutritious, healthy food, and therefore there's an increased likelihood that food producers and food retailers are going to go back through to their suppliers and ask them to use less chemicals, improve the traits when they plant seed, so that you get food of a better nutritional quality and that you get higher yields despite not being able to use these horrible chemicals, so that there is enough food and it's of the quality that people want. And there's all sorts of interesting companies that are looking at developing, say, for example, drought-resistant seeds using genetic engineering. I must point out that's not GMO, genetic modification, that's simply knocking out a gene. This is, you know, a technology routinely used in healthcare for producing certain drugs. We're just applying that now to the food system, and that will allow a seed to grow in an environment where perhaps there is more drought more frequently. I also think that people want their food to be fresher, and they want reduced food miles. And as I pointed out, there are parts of the world that are food producers and parts of the world that are food importers. So the development of controlled environment agriculture, so you may have seen, or your listeners may have seen photos of these warehouses where you grow microgreens and crops and certain fruits and vegetables inside, indoors, using ultraviolet light to replicate the sun, but you have zero pests, and therefore you don't need to use pesticides and herbicides. And you can locate them close to the consumer. So all that produce doesn't have to travel for days or weeks on container ships from one part of the world to another. And that reduces the carbon emissions of that food and also makes it fresher. I think also more food security. I think the future of food will look like one where we want to be less dependent on imports. And one way that a country like Singapore has done recently is try to incentivize investment into alternative proteins. It's the one country in the world where the regulators have allowed a restaurant to sell a lab-grown piece of meat. Obviously, that hasn't cleared regulatory boundaries in the UK, US, European Union, but Singapore is so dependent on food imports that they've taken a first mover advantage, taken a lead in trying to incentivize the alternative protein industry. Our belief is that most people will become flexitarian, so they'll eat less meat, more vegetables, more greens, more grains, etc. And there will be a proportion, likely to be small, that will be vegan, perhaps. So you'll see in the long term, in advanced economies, higher income households, less meat consumption. So I think this is what the future of food will look like. And I think all of this is designed to help society environmentally, in terms of nutrition, and in terms of food security and resilience.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of our listeners will be kind of aware of this, and we probably do have many listeners that have already transitioned to a vegan diet, or certainly a flexi diet, as you call it. We can see in restaurants that changes are already starting to be made, and in shops we're able to buy more plant-based products than we were before. So we can see that those changes are being made, but perhaps not quite as quickly as we would like. On the investment side of this, obviously partly what we're talking about today, what impact is this food crisis having on investment portfolios, and should charities that do have large amounts of money invested, should they be worried?
Yeah, it's a really, really pertinent question and very relevant for investors and charities who have investment portfolios. So what we've seen clearly is a very big change in the market regime to one where we have an environment of high inflation, and central banks are having to tackle that, and they don't want inflation expectations to become entrenched. And some of that is being caused by commodities, including food, but obviously oil and natural gas prices have also risen. And some of it's also from labor, not just in the food system, but just in the broad economy, a tightness and a lack of skilled workers for certain jobs, something called the Great Resignation, which I'm sure many of your listeners will have read about, where people have in the last 2 years through the pandemic chosen to exit the workforce. So that's causing inflation on that side too. The food crisis is therefore part of that inflation issue, and I don't think we'll see food prices normalize very quickly unless you see dramatic improvements in climate issues and on the geopolitics side. It's meant that you've had a bit of a headwind for certain types of companies in the investment markets. So for example, certain consumer staples companies that buy food to turn it into packaged food or food products have faced some headwinds. Many of those have been able to pass it on to consumers. And on the positive side, though, it's meant a great backdrop for companies that are involved in the agriculture side. So we've seen the price of corn, soy, and wheat double in the last 8 or 9 months. We've seen the price of fertilizer triple over the last 12 months. So those businesses are actually seeing tremendous growth in earnings power through this period, and actually have performed particularly well. I would also point out that Saracen and Partners, as an investment house and on behalf of our investors, has a range of different products. So we have the Food and Agriculture Opportunities Fund that I manage, but we also have our income products that our charity clients are unit holders and investors in. And those businesses tend to be companies that produce income in defensive parts of the market and have done particularly well through the last 12 months, faring better in a tough equity market backdrop. And that's because those businesses are ones where we've been very careful to make sure they have pricing power, that they can pay that income, those dividends to our unit holders, charities who are wholly dependent on income. And therefore, we feel quite encouraged that our investment process will lead us to pick companies that should be more resilient, more defensive in a difficult market environment.
So, how can investors find opportunities in companies that are helping that transition? I mean, where do you begin?
Yeah, I tell you, it's fascinating. What I'd say, the Food and Agriculture Opportunities Fund, which is obviously trying to find those companies that are transitioning the system to be less unsustainable, to be responsible, and are tapping into these new growth areas, alternative protein, controlled environment agriculture, precision technology used by farmers. We get really excited because there's all the time there are conferences I go to where there are private businesses that are looking to come to the public markets, maybe not straight away, but over the next 3 or 4 years. So we see our universe expanding. We find opportunities because our universe is very broad as well. So we own companies like John Deere and AGCO, which has brands such as Fendt and Massey Ferguson. So these are agricultural equipment firms that make tractors, combines, sprayers, planters. We think over the next 5 or 10 years, these are going to be very big beneficiaries of things like the EU Green Deal, where by 2030, all European Union countries have mandated to reduce the use of herbicides and pesticides by 50%. And one way to do that is to use technology like cameras, sensors, precision guided nozzles, use real-time data and analytics so that you adjust and only spray herbicide on the weed as you're making a pass of a tractor or sprayer across the field. So we think those companies are exposed to very strong growth tailwinds as farmers adopt more of those specialized pieces of equipment. And John Deere in particular say that they think their technology can reduce the application of herbicide by up to 78%. So you can see they think that we think those will be winners. Alternatively, the companies that make those herbicides and pesticides, the crop chemical companies like Bayer, which bought Monsanto, and FMC, a US listed company, we think they'll face headwinds. We think that volumes will shrink over the next 10 years. And so we don't own those companies in the fund. So that's just an illustration of how we can find opportunities that help that transition.
It's really fascinating because we've been talking about sustainable investment for years. And I think certainly for a lot of charities, perhaps that are listening today, they'll think about their investment portfolio and think, well, you know, I need to make sure that I'm not actively investing in any companies that are contributing to climate change. That might be a kind of key priority. But I wonder how many organizations will actually be thinking about the effect of their investments on the food system, certainly companies that produce the sort of pesticides and whatever else, but might not be at the forefront of their mind. And it's really fascinating to hear your insight in that. In fact, there probably are many charities that are listening today that are not particularly aware of the impact that their investment portfolio has on food sustainability at all, really. So I wonder how should these charities approach conversation with their investment managers?
I think it's very much a case of saying to your investment manager, firstly, do you understand how integral, and as you pointed out in the opening commentary, that the food system is anything between 25 to 30% of global greenhouse gas emissions. It is a major use of natural resources and natural capital. So things like fresh water and land and soil. So I think if a charity wants to ask those questions, they need to frame the questions around those issues, as well as the labor and social challenges that we talked about earlier, and then really push the manager to explain why certain particular holdings, equity holdings and the equity allocation are the companies that are helping with that transition. There are unfortunately still many packaged food companies, for example, that are not putting strong targets to improve their sourcing of deforestation-free soybeans, for example, or for example, companies that still are involved in producing beef rather than more efficient forms of traditional proteins such as poultry. Beef is far worse because you have to use 7 or 8 times the amount of kilograms of soy or wheat to feed the beef cattle for every kilogram that you get out. So the ratio is 7 or 8 to 1. Whereas if you switch to salmon, for example, it's a ratio of only 1.5 to 1. So it's a much more efficient use of grains and animal feed. So these are the sorts of things that a charity should probe and push their manager on as to whether they are thinking about this transition to a more responsible and less unsustainable food system.
And on that, actually, are you getting many inquiries from charities about the food system specifically? Is it a conversation that you've had regularly, or is it something that you're noticing is coming up gradually over time?
We've had this ongoing for a long time. This fund has been in place since 2008, so 14 years now. And we've noticed definitely an increase in the last 12 months as the environment has become one of food price inflation. So I get a lot more questions, both internally from colleagues, as well as externally from charities and other unit holders who are interested in how the food system has to change. I think for a long time, the food system didn't really have the spotlight shone upon it, unlike some other industries like the energy industry. So there was a lot of talk around migrating towards renewables such as solar and wind and away from oil and natural gas. But I think the food system will get increased scrutiny and more of a spotlight going forward. So I expect this to continue, more questions on this from charities.
Yeah, and you know, having this conversation today and putting this podcast out there to our listeners is hopefully a way of starting that conversation if it's not already being had. So, Janine, thank you so much for joining me. You've taught me quite a lot already, and yeah, it's been great to have you on our podcast.
Lovely. No, thank you, Lauren. Appreciate it. And thanks to everyone listening.
Thanks, Janine. If you'd like any more information on the topics discussed today, you can visit saracenandpartners.com. Alternatively, you can reach out to me at lauren.weymouth@charitytimes.com or visit our website, charitytimes.com.
Now for a quick disclaimer. Saracen & Partners LLP is a limited liability partnership registered in England and Wales with registered number OC329859 and is authorised and regulated by the UK Financial Conduct Authority. This podcast has been prepared solely for information purposes and is not a solicitation or an offer to buy or sell any security. The information on which the podcast is based has been obtained from sources that we believe to be reliable and in good faith, but we have not independently verified such information, and we make no representation or warranty, express or implied, as to their accuracy. All expressions of opinion are subject to change without notice. Please note that the prices of shares and the income from them can fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the exact amount originally invested. This can be as a result of market movements and also of variations in the exchange rates between currencies. Past performance is not a guide to future returns and may not be repeated. If you're a private investor, you should not rely on this podcast, but should contact your professional advisor.